We are back with a science news episode, where we aim to keep scientists up to date with the latest news, interesting facts, and disasters going on in science. In this episode, we'll talk about meat rice, millions of research papers being at risk of disappearing from the internet, the science behind hybrid working, and $47 million of research destroyed by a cooler failure. Welcome to the 77th episode of the Struggling Scientist podcast. We are a podcast by scientists, for scientists, anyone science adjacent, and perhaps even hobbyists. My name is Zanna, and I'm here with my co-host, Jaron.
Hi.
Let's start. Okay, we have very interesting science news for you guys again. Let's just delve right into our first topic, I would say.
Yes. So, it apparently was not a very holly jolly Christmas for researchers at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. So, over the Christmas holidays, it turns out that decades worth of research samples were destroyed due to a freezer malfunction. These are normally just liquid nitrogen tanks, which are kept at about minus 190 degrees. And sometime around the 22nd or the 23rd of December, around 16 of these tanks had a malfunction, which prevented further supply of new liquid nitrogen. And this wouldn't normally be a problem, but it turns out that they can only stay without a fresh supply of liquid nitrogen for about 4 days, and they ended up staying without it for 5 days over the holiday. Ooh. So there goes all their samples. And it was estimated, at least by news outlets, that the value of these samples destroyed was about $47 million. It's unclear what the actual value is, but also by the institutes and institutes themselves, they put it in the millions. We don't really have an idea of exactly what kind of samples were in there, but we do know about one type from leukemia patients from over the last 30 years. So you're not going to get those kinds of samples easily back anymore.
Ouch.
So yeah, very painful. I do have to mention that these samples were only for research purposes, not really it won't affect the healthcare or treatment of any patients or anything like that. So that's at least something. But you can also imagine that there were probably a lot of PhD students that were hired with the idea of researching a lot of these samples and doing their entire PhDs on that. And then suddenly gone. So, yeah.
That hurts. That hurts.
There goes your entire PhD potentially.
Yeah. 16 tanks also. Yeah. I was wondering how a freezer malfunction ended up in the news, but with 16 tanks, liquid nitrogen tanks, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And
it's also not one research group. That's the entire institute.
Multiple institutes, apparently. So it was at the Karolinska Institute, but apparently this is a multi-center thing, that they kept it there.
Oh, and so then you think it's really well-maintained and...
Yeah. So, there's no real indication that it was a deliberate crime or anything like that. But last I checked, they were investigating it still. So I don't know what there's been any new updates on that.
Okay.
So painful. So what's your next story?
Yes, my next story is about a paper that was published in Frontiers. It's called Cellular Functions of Spermatogenial Stem Cells in Relation to JAK-STAT Signaling Pathway. And it had this lovely image that YouTube viewers will be seeing on the side right now of an AI-generated rat with huge genitalials that isn't really anatomically correct. And according to the image, this was a ratatouille. Because also all the names that were indicating the anatomical cells and things like that were all completely bogus. Because it was, as the authors really nicely declared, all created with the AI tool Midjourney. And this was nicely disclosed, so that was all nice and proper. But these images were absolutely not scientifically correct. And the second one might be even more worrisome, because it showed the JAK-STAT pathway with just random proteins in there, arrows pointing in directions that are really wrong. I mean,
at least there were arrows pointing.
That's yes. More wrong you can basically not get. Now, this was a peer-reviewed article, and it was published on a Tuesday and already retracted on a Thursday because the scientific community found this paper, and on social media, it was basically posted everywhere. How did this get through peer review? Now, one of the peer reviewers actually responded, the US-based reviewer, Jinbo Dai of the Northwestern University, he apparently noticed the inaccurate images in the study, but failed to ensure that it was not published. And he told Vice that it was his responsibility to review the paper for its scientific aspects and recommended asking Frontiers about its policy for AI-generated figures. Frontiers investigated what the heck had happened, basically.
Actually looked at the paper.
And they said that indeed one of the reviewers expressed some concern about the images, but then the editor failed to exclude it from publication. And they also made a comment on their social media about how they thank the readers for the scrutiny of our articles. When we get it wrong, the crowdsourcing dynamic of open science means that community feedback helps us quickly correct the record.
That's people, one way of looking at it.
People looked also up what it costs to publish a paper in this journal, mm-hmm. and that would be $3,295.
Oh, I hope that was worth it for the journals. Like, oh yeah, we made money, but... Mm.
The only thing we really ask from journals for the money that we pay is basically the review process. That was absolutely horrible in this case. What are you paying that money for?
To put it online?
Yes. I can build a website for less money.
Yes, but you are not called Frontiers.
Yeah, well, actually, Frontiers... For many researchers, they think Frontiers is slightly predatory. Mm. And several editors have also left the journal because they found it impossible to reject junk articles. Mm. And yeah, it's still ranked as the third most cited publisher in 2022. And authors spend a lot of money publishing in this journal.
No, for sure.
Personally, yeah. I mean, I'm happy it's retracted. But the fact that this even made it through in the first place is just this.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
I mean, at some point, someone should have had just a look at this paper. It's like, at the very least, say something about like the image.
Well, apparently one of the reviewers did say something about the images. But the journal itself thought that since it was nicely mentioned that it was AI generated, it was fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm at a loss for words of just like, yeah.
Yeah.
You have one job, reviewers.
slash exactly. editor. Yeah. Well, journal.
Yeah.
Journal is supposed to make sure that this is not okay, that things that are not okay are not published, and to ensure a good review process. Mm. That's why you pay $3,000.
You would still get the $3,000 if you had just said like, okay, it's accepted under one condition, change this image or these two images, right? Like...
I also thought it was very funny that this journal really clearly indicates who the editor is and who the reviewers were. Mm. So when this whole thing blew up, everybody knew who the reviewers were that f***ed this up.
Yeah.
By name and institutes and country.
Yeah. Oh, I do want to touch on one point that you mentioned earlier about very anatomically inaccurate rat. Who knows? Maybe somewhere in New York, there's a giant rat that inspired this image. It had to come from somewhere. Somewhere online.
Yeah. I mean, they look very nice, right? These AI-generated images, but using them in research is just not okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I would ever refer to a giant rat thingamabob as nice, but...
I was also talking about the pictures of the cell culture and things like that. Okay.
For the record.
Let's just move on to the next subject.
So, from one piece of meat to the next piece of meat.
Okay.
That's called a segue, folks.
Oh.
So, introducing meat rice, grain with added muscles, beefs up protein. So, Suzanne, how does an edible, nutty rice-beef combo that can be prepared the same way that you'd normally prepare rice sound to you?
I mean, it doesn't sound that bad.
Okay, that's optimistic. Mm-hmm. And now, what if I told you the meat was made in the rice... in cell culture media, and the reason the rice looks pink, as I guess we'll show you on YouTube as well, is because the culture media has added phenol red.
It starts to sound less
yummy,
appetizing. At the same time, I'm all for cultured meat and less animal cruelty. So
no, for sure.
I'm trying to keep an open mind, but I cannot say it looks super appetizing.
Yeah, the rice doesn't necessarily look appetizing, but in theory, it should be.
I'm wondering, like, what kind of dishes can you make with it? What would it look cooked?
Yeah, fair. Yeah, I don't know. I imagine anything with some red or pink sauce or something like that immediately makes it all look a lot better.
Yeah.
But so, diving into the actual topic, maybe a little bit of background. So, lab-grown meats have already been a thing, and they're usually grown in a way that you need some sort of scaffold for them, for the cells to grow on. And it turns out that rice can actually function as that kind of scaffold as well for growing cells in the lab, meat cells specifically. And by using rice as the scaffold, it actually has the added benefit of adding nutrition to the rice. And this adds more fat to it as well as a little bit more protein content to the overall standard rice. So the researchers behind this study, which was actually published in the journal called Matter, hope that this creation of meat rice can help communities that struggle with food supplies. It can also maybe potentially help feeding troops that are at war, and potentially also reduce the need for raising cattle to grow meat like that. So this could be a much more sustainable, less impactful way of growing meat. But before you try to decide that doing something like this, growing meat in your own lab like this, is something you can do, it's a lot more complicated than just putting meat on the rice and just growing it. Apparently, the protocol also involves adding fish gelatin as well to the rice, as well as some other compound called transglutaminase to improve the overall attachment of the meat, or the cells, I guess, to the rice. Mm-hmm. And it takes about 1 week to grow the meat. And afterwards, you can wash and steam the rice just as you would apparently in regular rice. And then you can, I guess, use it for foodstuffs.
I like that the researchers describe it indeed as nutty and harder.
Yeah.
That means that they tried it.
They just poked it with a stick. It's like, I think we can call it this. Yeah.
Okay, so how healthy is this now?
Yeah, so according to the study, it's essentially the same as eating 100 grams of rice with effectively 1 gram of beef added to it. Like, you get the benefit of the same, like if you eat 100 grams of normal rice, 100 grams of this rice, you kind of just get 1 gram of beef value extra. So yeah, you get the more proteins and slightly more fat. So there's that. But the authors also do say that this can be improved by adding more cells in the beginning already. This is still just the starting phase of figuring this out.
Okay.
And I think also importantly for if this ever wants to make it outside of the lab is how much it will cost.
Mm-hmm.
The research team estimates that 1 kilogram of this rice would cost about $2.23 to make, which is basically comparable to normal rice prices of $2.20 per kilogram, and is way less expensive than a kilogram of beef, which is $14.88.
But it's not a kilogram.
It's not a kilogram of meat.
Yeah.
So that's also an important note. But ideally, you can sort of get something in between rice and beef.
Well, a kilogram of this rice would then contain 10 grams,
yeah.
10 grams of beef.
Yeah, but you could add more cells and, like, you know, you can...
They need to optimize.
Yes, this is still early days of beef rice. Thank you very much.
With how pink it looks, it looks literally like...
It's
like
all beef. Meat. Yes.
Like beef it looks. I had expected more of it.
Yeah, but that's just the fennel red talking. You haven't seen the beef.
Yet. Yeah. The other thing I'm slightly concerned about is that rice is kind of known to have ground bacteria in them as well, where you need to be kind of hygienic about using rice and then culturing it for a week. Sounds like a thing, but yeah.
I mean, we have to check if the researchers who ate the rice are still alive, but I assume...
Well, they published this. So yeah,
so, yeah, I mean, I assume it's doing
they
okay.
Had the master student try it.
Yeah, exactly. Bachelor student.
Okay. Mm. Okay. I mean, I love all the initiative to grow, to have lab grown meats for sure. So interesting.
Yeah.
But slightly better looking than it looks like ground beef, literally.
Yeah. A little light pinker, I would say. But I mean, if you're okay with ground beef, then this doesn't look that unappetizing, I guess. I mean, you still need to cook it and stuff, but...
Yeah.
Okay.
We are very excited to be able to introduce you to our new sponsor, Jenny AI. Not only does Jenny make our podcast possible, it also makes our life as scientists so much easier. Jenny is an all-in-one writing assistant that has everything that we have been missing in other AI tools.
Yes, first off, unlike other AI tools, it actually finds accurate information in papers and cites its sources. It does not make things up and only uses real, verified information that you can then also check the source of.
Second, it's a writing assistant trained for academic papers and helps you write your paper by suggesting the next sentence or the end of your sentence. Or, if you get really stuck, you can ask it to write an entire paragraph, completely removing the writer's block I so often struggle with when I don't know the right words to make my point. It helped me write an introduction to a paper I've been struggling with in half an hour. It even suggests which papers to cite. You can add your own library or search the entire internet for papers. Just type the add symbol to easily add a reference and it gets automatically added to the reference list.
And the last thing we absolutely love is that it has an AI chatbot that can see your document and give feedback on how to improve your manuscript. Or you can ask it questions, such as what are the potential therapeutic benefits of ... and it will search through the papers for you for the answer. I can only say that my stress level has gone down significantly since I started using Jenny. Check out the free version now at thestrugglingscientist.com/Jenny, and if you love it, use the code SCIENCE20 for a 20% discount.
Okay, moving on to the next topic. Millions of research papers are at risk of disappearing from the internet. All the hard work that we put into them. So there was this research, a study of 7 million articles by Martin Paul Eve. And he researched 7.438 million papers that have a DOI code. So that means that they are registered and should be referenced, are out there, basically. But he investigated and he found that almost 28% of the papers are not archived anywhere properly, which is a lot. That's how many papers are just disappearing. And it's, of course, a big problem if somebody has referenced this paper and you cannot check anymore where this information came from or what the original paper said. He also said that a lot of the archives specify that they have preserved a volume of a journal instead of like individual papers, which is then also becoming very, very difficult to find something. And of course, we're talking here about archives on the internet. We're not even talking about archives just in person for when the internet fails. But even on the internet, it's not archived properly.
Yeah.
And they looked at cross-ref members, so basically journals who are supposed to save these things. Again, that's why we pay them. Only 0.96% of them manages to save 75% of their content in three or more archives, which is the best way to make sure that it's actually safe.
Yeah.
A slightly larger percentage, 8.5%, seem to preserve 50% of their content in two or more archives. And many members, 57%, only met the threshold of having 25% of their material in a single archive. That could be detected, of course. Accessible for over the internet. 32% of Crossref members, using the data set that they were using, did not seem to have any adequate digital preservation in place against the recommendations of the Digital Preservation Coalition. It's a lot.
I'm already expecting I'll never find back my papers that I published at this point.
In a couple of years. Yeah, they are talking long-term finding back papers. The most recent paper shouldn't be a problem, but like long-term, this is going to be a more problem.
They'll be drowned out in the internet.
And it seems to be the biggest problem with the smaller publishers. And they recommend having a bit stronger guidelines for these DOI registrations, so that if you want that to happen, then you also have to make sure you preserve your journal, your paper properly. Yeah. As the journal, not the researcher.
I wonder if there's a correlation between amount of money spent on paying the journal and how well they preserve it.
I doubt it.
Yeah, it's like, right, if you go from 3,000 to 11,000, then you get three databases.
All we're like really learning in this episode is that everything that journalists need to do, they fail on.
Yeah, exactly. It's,
okay, all, not all of them, but
they,
like,
they process your payment very well.
Yes, they're very good at that.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one thing they really do.
They give a discount sometimes also if you're in the right institute.
Yeah. Mm. Or if you review the paper for
it. Oh, yeah. For free.
It's like,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Good
let's,
stuff.
Let's start dissing journals and let's move on to the next topic.
Yes, from journals to books, or sci-fi books in this case.
Okay.
So this is kind of research, kind of. it turns for the Dune fans out there. It turns out that the desert planet in Dune, the sci-fi series, is plausible, at least according to scientists.
Okay.
So Dune is this epic sci-fi series created by author Frank Herbert in like 1965. It has also been turned into a movie recently. So Dune Part 2 came out. And it takes place in the far future for humanity, where humanity has already become interstellar and moved to other planets. And there's one planet in particular in Dune called Dune, or its real name is Arrakis. Desert planet where you get this compound called spice.
Spice?
Spice, yes.
Okay.
I'm not going to go into the details of how the spice or the melange is made.
I will watch the movie.
Yes, it involves giant worms. The scientists also say that the giant worms are not plausible, just to be clear.
Okay.
But so Frank Herbert outlined a really rich desert world called Dune back in 1965 already. And at first glance, he goes into a lot of detail of how this planet looks and stuff like that. So a sci-fi series called Dune also attracts a lot of nerds. And in this case, it attracted actual science nerds with expertise in climate modeling, who apparently have enough free time to go research whether the planet Dune could actually be physically possible given its physics and environment, and could humans actually survive on it. So that's what they did, and I guess we'll show the visualization as well for that. We have an image of that. They modeled it and everything. This took about 3 weeks. The resource for this was the Dune Encyclopedia on the description.
Okay.
And they modeled it over 3 weeks using a supercomputer, so that's how...
Or they're just available.
Yes, in your free time.
Yes. This is also a Christmas holiday project.
I guess, yeah. And they say for the most part, the planet Dune or Arrakis is plausible. You do have to suspend your disbelief a little bit. For example, in the actual Dune series, it says that there's no rain possible on Dune. And their model suggested there would be a little bit of rain possible. So it's quite accurate for the most part. And you can actually find back the model that they made by going to climatearchive.org/dune if you want to see the entire model and look at surface winds, clouds, precipitation, temperature, and much, much more. If you're actually also interested, they didn't just do it for Dune, but if you're also a fan of the Wheel of Time, they also did it for the planet in the Wheel of Time. Because, of course, we just have time for this.
Yes.
And I think they also mentioned this work was carried out in their spare time, and it is intended as an appropriate outreach piece to demonstrate how climate scientists use mathematical models to better understand our world and exoplanets. So, again,
is good science communication.
This is very good science communication.
Good job, guys.
Yes. I love this. So, I kept getting more excited as I was reading this, and definitely check out the climatearchive.org. And I should also mention, the reason that this is also impressive is that Dune was written in 1965. It was only 2 years after that that the person who won the Nobel Prize for a sort of climate modeling, they published their research on climate modeling. So, and also Frank Herbert didn't have access to any computer, any supercomputer, nothing. He just like off the top of his head, and it's relatively accurate.
Ah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Okay, let's move on to hybrid working for scientists. On this planet, indeed.
No worms included.
This was a Nature news feature from David Adam, where he basically looked at a lot of different studies together, outlining if researchers should be working remote or not. So let's go over some of the research that he mentions. So in 2016, 4% of full-paid days jobs in the United States were working from home, This proportion rose, of course, due to corona to 60% in May 2020 and has since leveled out to 25%, but a lot more than it used to be. And in the UK government, this is actually similar because they showed almost half the workers were spending some remote time during 2022-2023. Okay. Now in science, we of course have been collaborating with other groups and other teams from across the world for a bit longer. In 2011, an analysis looked at the addresses of 39 million authors of research papers and how far they were apart. And they saw that this had increased from only 343 kilometers in 1980 to 1,553. In 2009. So we really have become more international in our research, which I think is a great thing to do. Now back to research about working remotely. In the 1980s already, the American Express Banking Corporation did a big study where they had people with disabilities work remotely. And they said that it was a really successful project because it was cost saving and it increased productivity of the workers. But the union officials were worried about exploitation of these people, and they called for a ban on electronic home stations. How the world has changed. Yeah. Now, more recent studies are actually smaller groups, such as on call center workers or IT professionals, and they actually show that remote workers tend to be less productive by about 10 to 20%. Handle fewer calls and enter less data and take longer to perform some the same tasks. While during Corona, a lot of people, of course, claimed that they were so much more productive working from home, these studies tend to show otherwise. Mm. Studies do show, however, that workers are a lot happier if you give them the option to work remote. Mm. They want to be flexible and, of course, also have less commute time. And they are also less likely to leave your company if you give them the option to work partly remote or fully remote. And in this specific study, the overall productivity was the same when they had a hybrid groups versus fully office-based groups. Okay, the problem, of course, with Corona is that we have seen the effects on short-term. Mm. Most of these studies were short-term based. But what happens if we work remotely for years?
Yeah.
So Carl Fay, an economist at the University of Oxford, actually did a study. And he actually found, specifically for researchers, that remote work can alter the nature and quality of what the researchers produce. So he found that teams that work remote are less good at being creative together and coming up with new ideas, while they are better at making incremental progress. But he really analyzed a whole lot of papers, 20 million research articles published between 1960 and 2020, and 4 million patent applications submitted between 1976 and 2020. Mm. And he looked at that and he just found that when the collaboration distance increased from 0 kilometers to more than 600 kilometers, the probability of disruption fell about 20%. Which is an interesting result. Mm. There are a couple of reasons why they think this is the case. They think the sporadic encounters are just really valuable. Mm-hmm. Also, being in person with each other exposes you to knowledge of the other person more often. Which
and
can,
resources
of course,
from the other people as well.
It can, of course, be very valuable. And the collaboration intensity tends to drive innovation also by bringing people together. Okay, they also say that it can be really important to have the opportunity to have informal conversations instead of just having really formal Zoom meetings, because they also mentioned that we all know how hard it can be to get your professor to answer an email, but if you run into him in the hallway, it becomes all of a sudden way easier to ask him your questions.
So,
another really interesting thing that they have investigated is that by analysis of 241 million articles published by more than 244 million researchers over the last two centuries, they showed that the longer that scientists work in the field, the less often their research is classified as disruptive. And this trend has become more pronounced in recent decades. In the 1960s, researchers with 20 years of experience produced more than 2% of the most disruptive work, so not a whole lot. But by the 1990s, that had slipped to less than 0.5%. And they showed that through the analysis of all these publications and how they were cited, showed that older scientists were much more likely to criticize emerging work than they were to produce innovative research themselves. Which...
disheartening.
Yeah. So you need your young PhD students to keep you disruptive, basically.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this was done by one group, but also Melanie Brooks and Jonathan Levav from the Columbia University and Stanford University asked volunteers to, in duos, come up with a new alternative for objects such as frisbee discs or bubble wrap. Mm. And they had to brainstorm about this, either in person or over Zoom. And they found, again, that the people who are in person were much better at coming up with new ideas than the online person did. But then in the follow-up tests, once the ideas had been generated, the remote pairs were just as effective as the in-person pairs.
Mm.
Now, they have a reason why they think this is. They showed that people were still very able to pay attention to each other and mimic each other's facial languages. So that worked all well.
Mm-hmm.
But with eye tracking technology, they actually showed that people over Zoom paid way more attention to the other person on this tiny little screen than they did well in person. And that might limit your brain capacity to just having creative ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they thought that this was. Now the article doesn't really go into recommendations any further than this, but it does seem to be that for real idea
generation,
you are better off being in person. But for the further figuring out of working out these ideas, so paper writing, for example,
mm-hmm.
you are also fine being more remote.
Need to be more remote for paper writing. I want that.
So. Like focusing on having real brainstorming sessions with your group in person can be a really useful, valuable asset.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what I took out of this article.
Yes. I also wonder, did they measure how happy these scientists were?
No.
I think that's also an important measure.
We don't care about happiness of scientists. Yeah. What's this kind of question?
Yeah. I'm also just thinking, right, because you mentioned earlier on that working remotely could reduce productivity by 10 or 20% for one of the groups, not the scientists, I think. But
yeah, no, the call workers and the IT professionals, yeah.
Yeah, but if they stay around longer and
they tend to quit less, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Then you sort of get that back and you don't have to pay for their travel costs. You don't have to rent.
Yeah.
You save money even though your productivity, I don't know.
And it also seems that the hybrid sometimes doesn't have this effect, so... Yeah. More studies are needed, especially for the long-term effects.
Yeah.
So but I don't dislike the idea of having just brainstorming sessions with your group and maybe also emphasizing this a bit more during group meetings.
Yeah, no, for sure. To really keep the because there are so many meetings that you just attend where it's I don't really need to be here, but I need to make my attendance known because someone else thinks I need to be here.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And structuring your group meetings maybe more as a brainstorming session instead of just a presentation where you mindlessly listen to what somebody's doing.
Yeah. No, for sure. Exactly. Actually having a purpose and use case for it that benefits most from actually being in person with the people. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. For our listeners, if you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, you can reach out to us via our website, thestrugglingscientist.com. You can also check out our website to sign up for the awesome journal, The Struggling Scientist. And if you have enjoyed this episode, then please leave a review or a rating on your favorite podcast listening platform, as this helps us grow and reach more struggling scientists out there who might need our help. You can follow us on social media. Jaron, which ones are those again?
X, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and YouTube. And also
Threads. Threads, yes.
Yes, Threads.
Thank you so much for listening, and we hope to see you again next time. Bye.
Bye.